mass production of a single type of product. Even though the obstacles to apply these concepts to a less restrictive environment looked insurmountable, Ono's genius and tenacity proved to us not only that it can be done, but how to do it. We now realize that TPS is restricted to relatively stable environments. Most environments suffer from instability, and relatively unstable environments have much more to gain from better flow than even stable environments. Now that we realize the above, shouldn't we follow in the footsteps of Taiichi Ono? Shouldn't we go back to the flow concepts and derive an effective application that's suitable for the relatively unstable environments? A time-based application of the supply chain concepts. The most intuitive base for the mechanism to restrict overproduction is not space or inventory, but time. If one wants to prevent production ahead of time, one should not release the material ahead of time. Using time as the base is not only more intuitive and therefore more easily accepted by the shop floor, it has an advantage that makes it suitable for unstable environments. It's much less sensitive to disruptions in flow. The robustness of the time-based mechanism stems from the fact that it directly restricts the overall amount of work in the system rather than doing it through restricting the amount of work between each two work centers. In flow lines or Kanban-based systems, the allotted inventories between work centers is restricted to the bare minimum, usually corresponding to much less than 1 hour of work. Therefore, when a work center is down for more than a short while, the succeeding work centers are almost immediately starved for work, and the preceding work centers are blocked from working. When, for any of the work centers, the accumulated time consumed by starvation and blockage is more than the excess capacity of that work center, the throughput of the company is reduced. The sensitivity of flow lines and Kanban-based systems stems from the fact that a disruption that occurs in one work center consumes capacity also from the upstream and downstream work centers, a phenomenon that almost doesn't exist for the time-based systems, since the work, once released to the floor, is not artificially restrained. The difficulty in using a time-based system is that, for each order, we should restrict the release of the corresponding material to be an appropriate time before the due date of the order. But how does one go about computing the appropriate time? When computers appeared on the industrial scene in the early 60s, it looked like we at last had the proper tool to handle the immense amount of details and calculations needed to compute the appropriate times for each material and order. Within 10 years, many computer programs to do just that were developed in numerous companies around the world. Unfortunately, the expected results of better flow and less work in process did not materialize. The problem is that the time it takes material to be converted to a finished product ready for delivery to the client depends more on the time it has to wait in queues, waiting for a resource that's busy processing another order or waiting in front of assembly for another part to arrive, and not so much on the touch time to process the order. It's commonly known that in almost any industrial operation, except for process lines and companies that use the Kanban system, the time that a batch of parts spends being processed is only about 10% of the lead time. As a result, the decision of when to release the material determines where and how big the queues will be, which in turn determines how much time it will take to complete the order, which determines when to release the material. We were facing a chicken and egg problem. In the 70s, it was suggested to handle that problem by reiterating the procedure, closed-loop MRP, to run the computer system, to check the resulting planned overloads on the various resources, the size of the queues, to adjust the due dates to eliminate the overloads, and to repeat this process until all meaningful overloads were eliminated. This suggestion did not last long, since experience showed that the process doesn't converge, that no matter how many iterations are done, the overloads just move from one resource type to another. As a result, already in the 70s, the usage of these computer systems was not to guide the precise timing of release of material to the shop floor, but rather it was confined to giving better information on the quantities and timing to order material from the suppliers. The official names of these systems was coined to reflect their major usage, Material Requirements Planning, MRP. The fact that such a mammoth effort did not yield a practical time-based mechanism to guide operations when not to produce should not be taken as proof that such a mechanism cannot be developed for the less stable environments, environments that must meet the due dates of an uneven flow of clients' orders. It should not even discourage us from attempting to use time as the base for a practical mechanism. But it should be a warning against an approach that tries to develop such a mechanism through handling the immense amount of details and calculations. What's needed is more of a bird's-eye view approach. Going back to basics, following the concepts of flow, the objective is to improve flow, to reduce the lead time. Taking time, rather than space or inventory, as the base for the mechanism to guide the operation when not to produce, mandates that we should strive to release the corresponding material an appropriate short time, just in time, before the due date of the order. But what do we mean by just in time? Even though the term just in time is a key concept in Lean, its use is figurative and not quantitative. In Lean, by production just in time, we certainly don't mean that the part that was worked on just now is needed to be at the loading dock ready for shipment in the next second or minute or hour. Actually, it's likely that even under the best Kanban systems, this part will not be worked on right away by the succeeding work center, as can be deduced from the fact that full containers are routinely waiting between work centers. So, what time interval will we consider to be just in time? More explicitly, if we want to restrict overproduction by restricting the release of the material, how much time before the due date of an order should we release the material for that order? One way to reach a reasonable answer is through examining the impact the choice of that time interval has on the magnitude of the management attention required to meet all due dates. Suppose that we release material before the due date by just the time it actually takes to process the order. Such a choice will necessitate a lot of management attention to closely monitor operations, since any delay in any operation, or even a delay in moving the parts between operations, will result in missing the due date. Moreover, precise scheduling will be needed to ensure that no queues will occur, since any queue causes a delay for the parts waiting in the queue. This is certainly not a practical choice. Even infinite management attention will not be sufficient to meet all due dates. We must choose a longer interval of time, an interval that contains safety to accommodate delays. The need to include safety is the reason for referring to the time interval of release of material before the due date as the time buffer. Choosing longer time buffers elongates the lead time and increases work in process. But since longer time buffers means more safety time, expectations are that, with much less management attention, a higher percentage of orders will be completed on or before their respective due dates. This is correct for relatively short time buffers, but when the time buffers are considerable, another phenomenon starts to raise its ugly head. What we have to bear in mind is that the longer the chosen time buffer, the earlier material is released, which means that more orders are simultaneously present on the shop floor. When there are too many orders on the floor, traffic jams start to occur. The more traffic jams, the more management attention is needed to sort out the priorities. Operations that implemented Ford's or Ono's systems enjoy an average lead time which is only a few times longer than the actual touch time, and management does not have to invest almost any attention to guide the shop floor personnel on what to work on now. As we said, in conventional plants, batches of parts spend only about 10% of the time being processed, About 90% of the time, the batches are either waiting in a queue for a resource or waiting for another type of part to be assembled together. What we learned from Ford, and more so from Ono, is that we shouldn't accept the size of batches as given, that economical batch quantities are not economical, and instead, we should and can strive to reach a one-piece flow. Armed with that conviction, it's easy to realize that when a batch of parts is being processed, except in processes like mixing or curing, only one item is actually worked on while the other items in the batch are waiting. That means that in conventional companies that use batch sizes of more than 10 units in a batch, which is the case in the majority of production environments, the touch time is actually less than 1% of the lead time. There is another phenomenon that typifies these companies. Whatever the formal priority system is, if a formal priority system exists at all, the actual priority system is hot, red hot, and drop everything, do it now. Inefficient operations means being in a lose-lose situation. Lead times are very long, relative to the touch time, inventories are high, and in many cases the company suffers from poor due date performance, less than 90%, in spite of high management attention. Bearing in mind that if management would have chosen a shorter time buffer, the situation would be remarkably better. How can it be that the vast majority of conventionally run companies are in that lose-lose situation? The answer was given by Ford and Ono. Through their work, they decisively proved that, contrary to the common belief, striving to constantly activate all resources all the time is not a recipe for effective operations. On the contrary, the exact opposite is true. To reach effective operations, local efficiencies must be abolished. But conventional companies do try to reach full activation of resources. Whenever the upstream resources are not bottlenecks, and that's the case in the vast majority of environments, they will from time to time run out of work. To prevent it, material is released, material that's needed for more remote orders, or even for forecasted orders. The unavoidable consequence is longer queues. Longer queues cause some orders not to be fulfilled on time, which in turn is interpreted as, we should release the material earlier, and is also interpreted as, we don't have enough capacity. A good starting point for improving flow will be to choose the time buffer to be equal to half the current lead time. There's no point wasting time by trying to find or calculate the optimum point. The immediate benefits are too significant to postpone. Restricting the release of material to be just the time buffer, half the current lead time, before the corresponding due date of the orders, will considerably improve the due date performance, will reduce the lead time to half of what it is now, and therefore, as the excess inventories are flushed out, will shrink the work-in-process inventory to less than half of its current level. But one cannot expect that this change alone will bring the due date performance to the high 90s. Simply, there are still many orders on the shop floor. There are queues in front of resources, and leaving to chance the sequence in which the work is processed will cause many orders to finish late. A priority system is needed. The need for a priority system should not open the gates for sophisticated algorithms to set the priorities. The number of orders coming in is constantly changing. The content of work differs from one order to another. The length of the queue is constantly changing, and let's not forget that disruptions still occur. In short, this is an environment with high variability. The lesson that Schuhart brought to manufacturing from physics, and Deming made known worldwide, is that trying to be more accurate than the noise, in our case trying to use sophisticated algorithms that consider every possible parameter in an environment of high variability, does not improve things but makes them worse. The results will most certainly not be an improvement, but a deterioration in due date performance. A straightforward priority system emerges when we recognize that the time buffer, being half of the current lead time, is still much longer than the touch time, and since it dramatically reduces the traffic jams without any interference, Many orders will be finished within just one-third of the time buffer, and the majority will be finished within the first two-thirds of the time buffer. Based on that realization, priorities are assigned by buffer management. Per batch, the time that has passed since its release is tracked. If less than one-third of the time buffer has passed, the priority color is green. If more than one-third but less than two-thirds, the priority color is yellow. If more than two-thirds, the color is red. If the due date has passed, the color is black. Blacks have higher priority than reds, etc. If two batches have the same color, to try and decide which one should be worked on first is an excellent example of trying to be more accurate than the noise. Putting such a system on the shop floor is relatively easy. In the first step, there's no need to do any physical changes, just to choke the release of material to be half the historical lead time before the corresponding due date and to guide the shop floor to follow the color code priority system. The impact is impressive, especially when compared to the efforts required. Of course, local efficiencies must be abolished, otherwise the pressure to release material too early will continue. Experience shows that the speed at which everybody on the shop floor realizes the positive impact makes that change almost resistance-free. But in most environments, there are still orders that miss their due dates, and there's still enormous potential for improvement to capitalize on. The fourth concept must also be translated into practice. A focusing process to balance flow must be in place. The first step in balancing the flow is relatively easy. Choking the release of material exposes the abundant excess capacity that was masked before. But it's likely that some work centers have less excess capacity than the rest. These work centers are flagged, since they do have a queue of inventory in front of them. The fact that local efficiencies are abolished helps to identify the simple actions required to increase their capacity. Simple actions, such as ensuring that a capacity-constrained work center will not stay idle during lunch break or shift changes, and offloading work to less efficient work centers that have ample excess capacity, are some examples. Since the above actions add effective capacity to the work centers that cause queues, the queues become shorter and fewer orders reach the red status. This means that the time buffer becomes unnecessarily long. An effective rule to adjust the time buffer without taking a risk of deteriorating the high due date performance is to decrease the time buffer when the number of red orders is smaller than 5% of the number of total released orders, and to increase it when the proportion of red orders is more than 10%. A company that follows the above will, within a few months, find itself with very high due date performance, considerably shorter lead times, and ample excess capacity. This is when the real challenge begins. In the past, sometimes, too many times, the reaction of top managers to the fully exposed excess capacity was to right-size the capacity and gain cost savings. This is a grave mistake. The excess capacity is employees who just helped the company to improve, and as a direct consequence, are rewarded by losing their jobs or their friends' jobs. In all the cases when such a misguided action was taken, the unavoidable backlash quickly deteriorated the plant performance to worse than the starting point. Hopefully, such top management behavior is behind us. The more sensible way to deal with the exposed excess capacity is to capitalize on it, to encourage the sales force to take advantage of the improved performance to gain more sales. The increased sales can easily cause the emergence of a real bottleneck. Ignoring the bottleneck's limited capacity when giving due date commitments to new orders will deteriorate the due date performance, and sales from disappointed clients will plummet. It is essential to strengthen the tie between sales and operations. That's the real challenge. A system must be put in place to ensure that every due date commitment is given only according to the yet unallocated capacity of the bottleneck. The bottleneck becomes the drumbeat for the orders. The time buffer translates due dates into release dates, and the action of choking the release becomes the rope that ties the order to the release of work. That is the reason this time-based application of the theory of constraints became known as the drum buffer rope system, or in short, DBR. Currently, there's widespread experimentation to polish a process to further improve operations based on recording and analyzing the reasons for the red orders. Example of Hitachi. By 2008, Hitachi Tool Engineering Limited had become a 24 billion yen company that designs and manufactures over 20,000 different cutting tools. The demand for most of their products is sporadic, and the customs of their industry force them to launch new product families of tools every 6 months. When new product families are launched, the older families become obsolete. No wonder their efforts to implement lean were unsuccessful. Hitachi Tool Engineering Limited started implementing DBR in one of their four plants in Japan in 2000. The jump in due date performance from 40% to 85%, associated with cutting WIP, work in process, and lead times in half, along with the ability to ship 20% more products with the same labor force, encouraged them to expand the implementation. By 2003, they had implemented DBR in all four plants. The drastic reduction in lead time and the much better responsiveness enabled a reduction of inventory in the supply chain, the outside distributors, from 8 to 2.4 months worth. The reduction of inventory dramatically improved the distributors' return on investment, freed up their cash, and strengthened their relationships with Hitachi. No wonder the distributors expanded the range of Hitachi tools that they were offering, leading to an increase of 20% in sales in a stable market. The true impact is revealed when we evaluate this company's bottom-line performance, keeping in mind that during the period of 2002 to 2007, the price of raw materials, metals, increased much more than the increase in the selling price of cutting tools. Under such conditions, the profits of the company should have vanished. Instead, the annual net profit before taxes of Hitachi Tool Engineering Limited increased from 1.1 billion yen in the fiscal year ending March 2002 to 5.3 billion yen in the year ending March 2007, a five-fold increase in net profit in 5 years. The profit ratio of Hitachi Tool Engineering Limited increased from 7.2% in 2002 to 21.9% in 2007, the highest ratio ever reported in this type of industry. The boundaries of DBR. As was highlighted before, an application makes assumptions, sometimes hidden assumptions, about the environment, and we should not expect the application to work in environments for which its assumptions are not valid. The assumption that DBR makes is apparent. It assumes that the touch time is very small, less than 10%, compared to the current lead time. This assumption is valid for many, if not most, typical production environments. But definitely, it's not valid for a very broad range of environments that are traditionally called project environments. In project environments, the touch time is relatively long, and the eagerness of the clients to get the project completed forces operations to promise lead times which are only twice or rarely three times longer than the touch time. It's no wonder that the performance is so bad that no one expects to get the project completed on time, in budget, and with the full content. Something is expected to give. But we should not conclude that since DBR's assumption is not valid, DBR is inappropriate for project environments. A different application, an application that directly addresses the relatively long touch time, is needed. This approach is called critical chain. Beyond the goal. Ellie Goldratt on production according to the theory of constraints. This is an excerpt of the Goldratt S&T series, moving from make to stock to make to availability. Goldratt programs are available at www.toc.tv.
Let's review where we are. We've started with aligning production to actual demand. In other words, we've shifted the focus from the efficiency of the plant, trying to produce as much as our resources are capable, to restrict the production to be in line with what the market wants. What were the steps that we've taken? We first of all have determined, logically, common sense way, based on the information that we have, being totally aware that the information is not deterministic or accurate, we have determined, first of all, the levels of inventories that we should have if we want to provide very high availability. Then, once we had that, and this didn't take too much time, as we said, few days, we went to the shop floor, and we sorted out the production orders. We took out the production orders that we don't need. In other words, we have already enough inventory to satisfy the market demand. We trimmed down the quantities to be in line with what we really need. And, not less important, we issued orders for products that we do need. And then we've established the priority system on the shop floor. The priority system that is totally in line with one objective, which is having full availability. What were the results? What must have been the results? Availability became much, much better on the spot because we revealed so much excess capacity. We didn't use it just to make sure that the people are working, but whatever is not needed, we are not producing now. So, of course, we have exposed a lot of capacity. And this capacity was used in order to align much better the finished goods, which means availability have improved dramatically in a very, very short time. While the inventories are now taking a nosedive. Remember, when we set correctly the targets for inventory, we took into account that the lead times inside the production will drop to minimum half. And because of it, the inventories now are very rapidly are reducing to what? To about half the level of inventory, if not less, than what we had before. How much time it will take until we reach there? Well, it depends on how much we were not good before. Because if, for example, from a particular product, we have 6 months of inventory where we should have 1 month, until we reach the 1 month, it will take another 5 months until the market will take it. But definitely remarkable improvements. Then, in the cases where the company operates through regional distribution centers, we have now done the exact same thing in the regional work centers where we've established what should be the inventory levels there, and they are by far less than what we had before, simply because of replenishment time. Now that we can rely on the fact that the products are available at the center warehouse, at the plant warehouse, replenishment time is just transportation. And because of it, enormous reduction in the inventory levels that have to be held in the regional warehouse is dictated. Full availability, the service level now to the clients is at levels that almost are regarded as a dream. And the inventories are reducing even more. Why? Because now that we hold most of the inventory in the central warehouse rather than the regional warehouse, the impact of the variability of the market has been reduced dramatically. I hope that you paid attention to it. The variability per regional warehouse in relative terms is much higher than on the central in the central warehouse where we have the aggregation. By taking the inventory backwards, we have caused the inventory to be even lower than before. Basically, the inventories now are diving toward about one third of the inventories that we had before. Very impressive, excellent results. And that's where the big danger is, because the situation now is improving in such remarkable speed and so significant that you might be under the impression that we finished, that we've done whatever we could have done in production, and maybe we can still improve it, but this is only in the fringes. We've reached the diminishing returns. That's not the case at all. So let's highlight it in more depth. Let's highlight that actually the room for improvement that is still available if we just take the prudent actions is even bigger than what we've done so far. Let's talk about dealing with disruptions to flow. Have you noticed we have not yet improved the plant itself in terms of the local improvements that we can do? Do you really believe that every machine is maintained perfectly, that everything is running smoothly on the shop floor? We have changed the mode of operation, but we didn't dealt with so many disruptions that exist yet on the shop floor. Should we? And the answer is definitely yes. But in what way and how to go about it? So that we continue this momentum that we build, that every action that we take delivers almost immediately significant results. If we will not pay attention to that, we will end up where most of these improvement projects is ending up, which is lip service. So let's go and analyze it logically. When surplus inventory does not populate the queues, any improvement in flow translates into shorter replenishment time. Very important concept. Look, before that, the queues were populated with so many orders calling for production of products that we really don't need them. So improvement in the local processes, even though it improved the flow, it didn't improve the company because it just improved that we can do faster the wrong things. So the first things that have to be done is, of course, to populate the floor only with things that we need. But when this is done, and we've done it already, every improvement to flow now translates one-to-one to what? To reduction in replenishment time, and that's why it translates into lower inventories that we have to hold in order to ensure perfect availability. That's the time to pay attention to it. Shorter replenishment lead times, better flow, enable the system to hold lower levels of inventory while increasing the flexibility to react to changes in demand. Obviously, the need to continuously improve flow is imperative, considering that the constantly generated increase in demand reduces flow. Look, we have now ability to service the clients like never before. This means sales will grow. If sales grows, the reaction time to the increased sales may go down. We simply don't have enough surplus capacity. This will mean deterioration in the service will start. To prevent that, we can take one of the two things. Either to add more capacity, and remember, adding capacity is very expensive, or to improve the flow by taking care of the problems. Don't you see what is the outcome of all of that? The strategy that we must adopt, and this must be the governing strategy for production. Better flow is regarded by production as the most important element under their control to improve availability. This becomes the motto of production. Yes, there are other actions that can be taken to improve availability, but these actions cannot be taken by production. But production can take the action, which is improving flow, which has dramatic impact on that. So that's become their motto. Let me here stress the more generic concepts. Some of you have read the article that I wrote called Standing on the Shoulders of Giants, where I've analyzed the work of the big giants of industry, starting with Ford that invented the flow lines, and then going to the person that I consider the biggest genius in industry, in operations at least, which is Dr. Ono. the one that have not just invented but implemented the Toyota production system, the one that all of Lean came out of it. And what I have tried to show in that article is that they followed rigorously the four elements, the four basic steps of flow. The first one is that improving flow is the main objective of production. Exactly like we said before. The second one is that in order to go about it, not just give it lip service, you have to establish a mechanism and to implement a mechanism that prevents overproduction. Yes, flow lines are so effective not because they are conveyor belts, but because there is limited space in front and after every work center in a line. And if this inner line, a work center, filled up the space after it, and he continues to produce and spill it on the floor, nobody regards it as effective. In other words, the real thing there is don't produce when it's not needed. Same thing is definitely for the Kanban system. You don't have a Kanban card. You may be a very expensive worker working on a very expensive machine, but if you don't have a card, you are not allowed to produce. These are the mechanism to prevent overproduction. That's the first step, because otherwise the flow is populated with so many things that shouldn't be there. And then improving the flow does not help the company. It just improve and enable us to do faster the things that we shouldn't do in the first place. What we've done so far is we actually implemented the mechanism that prevents overproduction. Haven't you noticed? We've established what the levels that we need from finished goods, and we are making sure that only those levels will be maintained, no more. And in order to enable that, we have to condemn local efficiencies, because otherwise what will happen? Now that we have excess capacity, even if the inventories are appropriate, even if we have reached all the levels that we wanted to reach in finished goods, since we do have people which don't have what to do all the time, we will make sure that they are working. In other words, we will violate the basic rule of flow. But then comes the fourth element. And the fourth element is, now that you prevented the overproduction, you have to balance the flow. In other words, you have to concentrate to take all the disruptions that slow down the flow. Only then. You see, this is one of the problems of theory of constraints. Practical problems. When Ford have put his rules of preventing overproduction by limiting the space, or when Ono have put his rules of preventing overproduction by limiting the amount of inventory per product that is allowed to accumulate between each two work centers through the Kanban system, the immediate result of these actions was that the total output of the company, the throughput, went down. And that's why there was no choice but to continue immediately to start to improve the flow by addressing the local processes. The problem of TOC is that the mechanisms that we are using to prevent overproduction, rather than reducing the throughput of the company, have increasing it dramatically while reducing the inventories. And because of it, there is a tendency to think that we've finished, that it's okay, that we've already got all the improvements. No way. We do have to continue, exactly like Ford and Ono have done. We have to continue to deal now with the local disturbances in order to improve things by another order of magnitude. That's imperative. But this does not mean that we have to deal with every disruption, because there are so many disruptions, there are so many things that can be corrected. The question is, to build the mechanism that prioritize which disruption should be dealt with. You know what will happen otherwise. What disruptions are we going to deal with? Not the ones that it's important to take out, but the ones that we know how. Grave mistake. In lines, it's so obvious what to deal with. Because if one work center in the line stops, very soon the whole line stops. In Kanban, in just-in-time or lean Toyota production system, Ono had to establish a whole mechanism in order to guide where should the disruption be dealt with. The whole mechanism known as by reducing the number of Kanbans and then reducing the number of items per container, where he put the target to be one piece flow. We have to establish now the mechanism that will tell us where to concentrate, on which disruptions we have to eliminate. That's what is standing now in front of our eyes. Let's see how to build such a mechanism. Interesting, right? Yes, we have done fantastically so well. This does not mean that we cannot do much, much more. But what I'm stressing is if you don't take the next step, you've just left more than half of the benefits just laying on the table. Everything's ready for it, provided that we'll continue to think and find exactly what is a mechanism so we don't shoot in the dark. What are the parallel assumptions that the facts of life that can guide us in building such a mechanism? First one is, an accumulation of work in process before a work center is a clear indication that the work center contains a source of disruption to flow. Correct? Why is it piling there? Because it cannot move fast enough. What does it mean? There is something that prevents it. So here is a source of disruption. But there is another angle to it. When the source of disruption affects several work centers, accumulation of WIP cannot be used as a guide to the source of the disruption. A more elaborated mechanism is needed. What do I mean by a source of disruption affects several work centers? Let me take a very clear case that I have seen back in 1981. The problem was that there was not enough capacity of the forklift. And the forklift had to move the big heavy containers from one work center to the other. And simply there wasn't enough capacity of the forklift. And because of it, what happened? Of course, flow was disrupted. But in the morning, the pile was here. And then when the forklift came, the pile was there. And the next day, the pile was a total different place. There was not a constant accumulation in front of one work center simply because the source of the disruption was not the work centers themselves. It wasn't so easy, by the way, even though in retrospect it was unbelievably easy, to identify that the real disruption is not in the work centers at all. It's in the capacity of the forklift. After that, I've seen so many other cases where the source of disruption can be, for example, the tool room, or it can be some policy that batches work in such a way that it affects many work centers, or some a quality control procedure that is not applied in one place but in several work centers. How to find out the source of disruption when it affects several work centers is not a triviality. But if we will not do that, we will try to improve each work center, and we'll improve them. The only problem is that this improvement does not contribute to the improvement of the whole plant. It's pure waste. So what do we have to do? The overall tactic is disruption to flow are identified and effectively removed. Fine. But now, because of what we said before, let's understand the guideline. And this is given in the sufficiency assumption. When a quick and dirty technique can yield significant results, It should be used before the better, but longer to implement technique is put in place. Look, that's exactly our situation. From one hand side, we have a very crude, very quick technique, which is where is the accumulation of the working process. This does lead to wear in cases that the source of disruption is in the work center itself. Yes, it does not help you to find sources of disruptions that are affecting many work centers, but it does help you to find a major part of the disruptions. This is something that we can do right now. Let's do that. And not delay everything to say, okay, let's first of all build the whole process that will enable us to find any disruption. This means that when we are going now to actually do the improvements, we have to separate into two steps. First of all, the localized disruptions, the one that can be identified by the accumulation of working process, and then to build a whole mechanism that can identify any disruptions, whether or not it's localized. Let's see how each one of them is done. First of all, let's start with localized disruptions. The longer the WIP is waiting in the queue, the bigger is the disruption to flow. For sure. Oh, by the way, this indicates something. The size of a queue should not be judged according to the amount of inventory, but according to the length of time the inventory waits. That's what is much more important. If you have a real disruption, this means that the inventory will wait for a long time. That's the real indicator. A queue before a work center can be reduced by increasing the effective capacity of that work center. Wait. This does not mean immediately go and buy more capacity. It means let's find how to utilize this work center much better. Unfortunately, the conventional mode of operation, that mode of operation which is totally dominated by local optima, musts opportunities to economically and rapidly expose more effective capacity from existing resources. Which means, even though we have something that is a problem for a long, long time, now we have to go and visit it. Because this new frame of mind of who cares about local efficiencies will enable us now to do basically miracles, to take actions that will solve the problem, even though conventionally we will never look at them. In a minute, we'll give you some examples. Basically, it means let's go back to that and let's do it now. Strategy. That's objectives that we want. Where relevant, hidden capacity is exposed. How? The source of the disruption is not necessarily lack of capacity. Typically, it is the mistake that prevents the exposure of the existing capacity. In most cases, additional capacity can be exposed by simple means like ensuring that the identified equipment is not idle during lunch or shift change breaks. Suppose that you're working three shifts. Is the equipment working full three shifts? I know that it's a naive question, so in order to explain why I'm asking it, let me tell you a real story. The plant is in Israel. The plant was producing bomblets for the big bombs. Never mind about the morality of doing it. Do mind, but not now. This was so important, and the quantities that were needed were so big that the Israeli DOD have approved a lot of money to buy all the sophisticated machines, and they put a fantastic line to produce these bomblets. The line was not producing the required quantities. They were falling behind about 15% relative to the target 1 month after the other. It became so bad that the Israeli DOD have threatened that they will take back the order and will transfer it to a plant in Germany. This means unbelievable insult to their pride on top of the financial loss. The line was working three shifts. Where is the accumulation of the working process in the line was obvious. Here is the machine that doesn't have enough capacity. Here's a disruption to flow. The procedure was that when the shift ends, people are now going to take a shower, change clothes, go to the buses that have brought the new shift to go home. These people who just came to populate the next shift now have to change clothes and then to go to the line. In short, whenever a shift change occurred, a whole hour was lost, effectively. The suggestion was, wait a minute. We are not talking now about the whole line. We are just talking about this work center that you don't have enough capacity. The one that is the problem here. This work center is populated by three people. Why won't we do change the procedure so that these people continue to work until their replacement came with the buses, changed clothes, and now they're ready to take over? Only then these people will go to take the shower and go home. Oh, wait a minute. But the buses have gone already. How can we bring these people to home? You know what? Take a taxi. They are not living in one place. Take three taxis. What are you talking about? Do you know how much the cost of a taxi? And to do it every shift? Then we've done the calculations. If we'll take these taxis, we are going per each shift change to win 1 hour. 1 hour of what? A flow of the whole line, throughput of the whole line. So we've done the calculation and turned out that each day, what is really the price of not having the taxi? The price is so high in terms of lost throughput, lost revenue directly to the bottom line of the plant, that they could have bought every day not just a taxi, but the license to the taxi. You understand now what I'm talking about in terms of local cost savings prevents taking obvious actions to improve the flow? So let's go back. We identified where is the biggest accumulation of work in process in terms of time. And then you ensure, you take actions like you ensure that the identified equipment is not idle during lunch or shift breaks. You are offloading work from the identified resources to less effective work center, but the work centers that do have ample access capacity. You use lean techniques to shrink the setup time on the loaded resources. These techniques are fantastic. Etc. This is the goal if you want more ideas. The tactic is the following. The work centers that have chronic queues means that not that it's accumulation once in a blue moon, but such accumulation, such stoppage in the flow occurs frequently. The work centers that have chronic queues are identified and rated. Rated means who is the first one to deal with, who is the second one, and so on. Improvement teams are guided to take prudent actions to expose additional capacity for these work centers. Remember, most of the time, the actions that has to be taken require changes beyond what the worker or even the foreman can approve. So make sure that the right people are populating these action teams. For example, the change in what I've described with this triviality about the taxis cannot be authorized by a foreman. You do that, you get the first pass. By the way, don't underestimate how big it is. But that's not enough. Now let's go and deal with the trickier ones, which are not less devastating. Dealing with disruptions, even in cases where they're not affecting just one work center. And here, you have to bear with me. We'll have to define a whole new nomenclature in order to deal with that, which means it's even more important than usual. First of all, what's the problem? When the source of disruption affects several work centers, accumulation of work in process cannot be used as an effective guide to the source of disruption. Simply, the accumulation, if it exists, and it does exist, moves from one place to the other. There is no stability here. You know this phenomena. The strategy is major source of all disruptions are identified and prudently dealt with. The question is, of course, how? Fine. For that, as I said, we'll have to define a few things. First of all, what is a disruption? A disruption is a delay in the flow. Something is waiting, that's a disruption. And if it waits for 2 seconds, it's a small disruption. It's still a disruption. But this definition tells you immediately we don't have to deal with any disruption. The problem with disruptions is that we cannot say, okay, small disruption, ignore. Why? Because for each work order, delays accumulate. If we have something that goes in through 10 different work centers, and each one of them has a disruption, these disruptions accumulates, so that the work orders, once he finished all of them, and each time he was delayed, the delay is now not small at all. It accumulates. So we cannot offhand say, these disruptions are too small. But on the other side, how do we deal with it? We have to define something which says, this disruption, even though it's small, due to the accumulation, it can really contribute. That's what leads to the next definition. In conventional environments, where the touch time is very small fraction, less than 10% of the average lead times, and as we said, this is the case in the vast majority of production environments, non-trivial disruption is defined as one that causes a delay longer than one-tenth of the average lead time. Usually one-tenth of the average lead time, since it's an order of magnitude smaller, one-tenth, I would have neglected. We cannot do it because, as we said, disruption accumulates. But if a priori it's one-hundredth of the lead time, even if disruption accumulates, it's still very small. Remember the rule. A cent plus 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 a cent is still less than a dime. So I will not look on cent. But if I'm talking about $10 plus $10, that's another story. So here is a definition of non-trivial disruption. Remember, the non-trivial disruption still may not affect anything if it doesn't accumulate. For that, and we need to continue on. Disruption that endangers high availability is a disruption that causes the finished goods inventory to reach the red zone or to stay in the red zone, which means real damage. Let me repeat again. The judge of what disruption is damaging is not by looking at the disruption itself, not by looking on the work center, but looking on its effect on what? On the availability. On the amount that it endangers availability. That's the judge if a disruption is serious or not. Now, what does it mean? It means the following. A major source of disruption is the one that systematically endangers high availability. With this nomenclature, we can now start to build the mechanisms that will enable us to identify what? The major source of disruption. The one that, if we will correct, will really improve the overall performance of the company. Most non-trivial disruptions are not and do not contribute to disruptions that endanger availability. Hello, even disruptions that you see that they delay things. This does not yet mean that they really endanger the availability. So by looking on the magnitude of the disruption itself, except for super extreme cases, looking on the magnitude of the disruption itself is not enough to say we have to deal with the source of the disruption. This is not the correct way. It will not lead us to focus our improvement efforts correctly. Likewise, in conventional environments, as long as there is enough protective capacity, more than 10%, most work orders, and when I say most work orders, I'm talking about more than 90% of the work orders, are expected to be completed in less than 2/3 of the average lead time. Still, a work order that took longer to finish might not point to a source of disruption since at that time its color might be still green, which means there is plenty of inventory in the plant warehouse. So even when I'm looking on a work order that was delayed to the extent that now it took twice as long to finish, this is still not telling me that the disruptions that this work order faced are serious enough to deal with. Because it might be that when it finished, even though it took twice as long, there was still enough inventory. And then it means correcting these disruptions will not improve the performance of the plant. It will not improve the availability. So if I cannot look on the disruption and I cannot look on the work order in order to identify what are the disruptions that are really important, the disruptions that endanger the availability, what should I look on? The combination. Let's see. What's the meaning of looking on the combination? Therefore, only a work order that is not finished in 2/3 of the average lead time and whose color is red is a valid indication of a major source of disruption. In other words, a work order which is late, and because it is late, already the inventory in the finished goods is too low. Only then I know that I have a problem. How do I build a mechanism based on that realization? No, it's not so difficult, but since the whole view is a little bit different, disruption is not a problem. A disruption that takes a long time is not a problem. A worker which is late is not a problem. What is a problem? Only the things that endanger the availability. To start to look from this angle is a little bit, at least takes time to adjust. And that's why, from first glance, it might look to you that the mechanism that I'm now proposing is maybe a little bit complicated. It's not. It's common sense the minute that you are used to think along that lines. What is the procedure? The cause for each non-trivial disruption is reported and stored in the general bank of disruption. In other words, whenever we have a delay which is non-trivial, remember the definition, a delay which is a delay for 1/10 of the lead time or more, the source for it, the cause for it should be written. What is the recommendation? What is the cause for it? Don't do any analysis. And don't tell the worker to tell us why the delay was there. Instead, ask what the work order is waiting for. What are you waiting for right now? And it might be an answer like, I'm waiting for the forklift. Or it might be, I'm waiting for this tool. Or I'm waiting for some oil. That's the cause. And that's register. Don't take any actions yet. Who says that this disruption is important in terms of jeopardizing the availability? But store all of this information. Now, per work order, the time from its release is tracked. So when I'm looking at work order, I should know this work order was released 4 days ago or it was released 7 days ago. When the time since the release of a work order is longer than 2/3 of the corresponding average lead time, and the color of the work order is red, in other words, here is a problem, all corresponding disruptions to that work order that were reported before, because remember, this work order until it reached this situation was delayed here, was reported 4 days ago, and then was delayed in another place, and it was reported, and then it's now delayed, and it is reported. All of the delays that were reported on this work order are now pulled from the general bank of reporting and are placed in the relevant bank of disruptions. In other words, we have this big bank of all the data of whatever disruption happened, when, to what work order, and what was the cause. We are pulling now from this bank into a special bank, much smaller, only in cases where we have a work order which is already very late, but then we pull all the disruptions that occurred to this work order in the past. What do we do with it? Nothing yet. Once appeared, for example, a week, Pareto on the relevant bank provides a major source of disruptions. In other words, now we are going once a week. We are looking on all the causes that were pulled into the specific bank, into this second bank, and we are doing a Pareto. How many times each one of them appear? This, the one which is on the top, is the one that we have to deal with. And then the second, and so on. Basically, what we have to do is cross-functional improvement teams are guided to take prudent actions to eliminate the major source of disruptions. In other words, they are going now over the result of this PERT analysis, start with the first one, say, fine. Now that we understand that that's what we have to deal with, let's analyze this in depth, let's find out what is the real cause, and let's find out what is the correction. For example, I'm waiting for, remember this where the things that were reported, forklift. So when I'm pulling it out, I will get as the first thing on the Pareto, the forklift is the things that the real problems we're waiting for too much. Fine. Now, what do we do about it? No. The answer is not so quickly, let's buy another 3 forklifts. Because it might be that if you add another 3 forklifts, there is no room for them to move. So instead of solving, you have just created a bigger traffic jams. You have to think carefully. For example, in this case, the answer might be, wait a minute, why do we need a forklift to start with? Because the containers that we are moving are 30 kilograms each. And so we cannot move it by hand. We have to use a forklift. But what prevents us from using containers of 5 kilograms and then it can be moved without any problem? That's a real example that was in reality. But you understand that to initiate such a thing, it's not the local teams that can decide it. Especially when many times this source for disruption is some policies that was dictated by who knows what, who knows whom. You need this cross-functional to really analyze it and come with prudent answers. Otherwise, the solution can be even worse than the problem. The Kaizen method, for example, for analysis, once you have such a focus, is excellent. Nothing special here. But if you do that, do you understand what is happening? The flow becomes much, much better. You've exposed more capacity and you shrink the lead time, which means not only that now you can provide this excellent service with much less inventories, you can, without additional investments or manpower, deal much better with changes in mix and increase in demand, which means every increase in demand, all the throughput portion of it will glide directly to the net profit. This action is what triples the net profits of the company. So please do it. That's what enables us to say, fine, we've achieved the alignment of the supply chain. We have achieved this fantastic competitive edge. Does it mean that we've achieved our objective? Not at all. We've achieved beautifully the first step. Remember what we said. Build is very important. We've, by that, done the build. Yes. But does it mean that our sales will go up? Yes. Rapidly? No. We have to learn how to capitalize on this fantastic competitive edge. And this is as big a problem as to generate the competitive edge. So we will have to discuss it in depth. Let me just read the topic for to understand how important it is. The required changes in the company's approach to capitalize on remarkably better service. The inventory turns offer is different in nature from the changes the company did in the past, new products or new markets. In other words, this is a fantastic paradigm shift for the salespeople. And if we don't take it seriously, and if we will not address it to the depth, the salespeople and your marketing is unable to take advantage of it. So you have a fantastic competitive edge and you'll waste it. In other words, definitely at this stage you are sitting on a gold mine, but this does not mean that you are digging the gold. It might mean that you are sitting on a gold mine and crying, or even worse, sitting on a gold mine, sales are going up a little bit because the clients are not blind to what happened, your existing clients, so you are very happy, but you actually missed the whole boat. We have to go and do the capitalized portion. Then you are talking about real benefits.
This has been a Highbridge Audio presentation.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.